Oh.
Hello, I'm Debbie Mackey.
And I'm Alan Mackey.
And we are your hosts on Left of Liberal, a program and a Facebook page we've created. Look for the white peace poppy when you look for our page. It's called Left of Liberal with hosts Alan and Debbie Mackey. We also have a contact info number at 512-517-2708 and an email, leftofliberal@outlook.com.
One of the main reasons we have undertaken doing this program, Left of Liberal, is because we feel very strongly peace and disarmament are central to most working class issues and form the basis for pulling together a massive, broad-based, all-people's front comprising liberals, progressives, and leftists, and many other people, irrespective of class, but the left, oriented towards working class issues, focused on anti-imperialism, is going to be the catalyst in educating and organizing this All People's United Front for peace and disarmament, for equality and social and economic justice, with socialism on the table now, not later. And, you know, we want people to, you know, listen to our program, and we hope that our program spurs a lot of discussion around people's kitchen tables and in their living rooms, in union halls, and where working people begin to talk about the issues of the day in a way that, you know, we can have a voice in the real decision-making process in this country. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight with our guest, Stuart Alexander, who ran on the Socialist Party for President, and Howie Hawkins, who's running on the Green Party, trying to get the Green Party nomination for president right now.
And we've got them coming on in a little bit. You want to make a notification about...
Yeah, we'll say a little bit about Rodney Reed this evening. We don't want to forget a program and forget Rodney Reed. You know, Rodney Reed is sitting on death row. He's scheduled to be executed on November 20th. And there's a new video out. You can go to the Reed Justice Initiative and find the new movie about Rodney Reed, and share that movie with your family and friends and neighbors and anybody you can, because we've got to educate a lot of people between now and November 20th that we're going to stop this execution. Rodney Reed is an innocent man. He's been framed in a very vicious racist frame-up, and we've got to stop this, and the only way to do it is by getting word out to lots and lots of people, and we got to get these people to start writing the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, insisting that Rodney Reed be exonerated, not executed. So, you know, check out that. And tonight, the Reed family is going to be live on Facebook. You can go to the Google Reed, Rodney Reed, and you'll come across their Facebook pages and stuff. And at 8 o'clock tonight, they're going to be on Facebook, so tune into that.
Are you with us, Stuart and Howie?
Yes, I am. Thanks for the invitation.
Yep, I'm here. This is Howie.
Okay, this is going to be kind of a relaxed discussion. It's nothing formal, so if you have something to say, just pop in if you need to. The first thing that we've had the last couple of days that maybe we want to discuss are the Saudi oil explosions, the attacks on the Saudi oil, and how the United States is blaming Iran for it, but we don't seem to know who's done it. Why are they blaming somebody if they don't even know who's done it? So I don't know. Does anybody want to say something about it?
Howie?
What? Howie, you got any comments about that?
Yeah, well, it's not our fight. You know, it's between the Saudis, Iranians, the Houthis. We don't know exactly what happened. Trump is asking MBL, who chops up journalists, you know, what he should do. You know, he shouldn't be asking other people what he should do. And he should be asking Congress, first of all, if he thinks we should go to war. But I don't know what dog we have in this fight. So, you know, we should stay out of it.
Yeah, I
well, personally, I think personally, I think we're so far away from being prepared to declare a war on Iran after this incident. They were already talking about war only hours after this vicious attack. And very often what I've seen in my lifetime is when someone is the first one to scream fire when it's a fight, and they're the ones that are screaming that foul, foul, very often I ask, you know, why were you there in the first place? And usually they are the first suspects. I look at forensic files all the time. And forensic files, what they usually look at is when there is a crime that is committed, they want to know who was there at the scene when the crime was committed. So if the U.S. was already there knowing exactly what took place and where the shells came from and like that, I think it needs to be a further investigation on the U.S. Where did you get your information? How can you conclude that Iran was at fault if you have so much information to bear? So these questions have not been answered, and we're following the same path that we did during 9/11, where there was a rush to judgment, weapons of mass destruction, and then they never did find the weapons of mass destruction, but they tried to justify that international crime by saying, well, we did bring democracy to those people. So we don't want to keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again. And I think this is where people like Howie, where it is so important that we have a campaign like Howie Hawkins running for president, where now we have a person that can be a voice and condemn not only the action, but condemn the actions of the United States for, again, making a rush to judgment.
Okay. Maybe before we go any further, Howie, you can sort of introduce yourself and tell us why you're running for president and give us a little bit about your background.
Okay, sure. I'm a recently retired Teamster. Worked in construction and as a Teamster for, I don't know, 45 years. I'm originally from California. Got drafted for Vietnam and enlisted in the Marine Corps, but I was already in the anti-war movement, so we had a GI movement back then. That's partly how we got out of the war. And I was involved in starting the Clamshell Alliance, anti-nuclear movement, anti-apartheid movement. I've been involved in movements since the 1960s, civil rights, peace, unions, the environment. And I was there at the first meeting that the Green Party had to organize a party in 1984, although I'd been supporting, you know, independent political action since the Peace and Freedom Party in 1968. So, you know, that's my background, and, you know, I retired and was planning to do some other things, and a bunch of people said, you should run for president, you know, we're in the Green Party, and they put together a campaign, and I respect these people, and I felt, well, okay, I guess it's my responsibility if they have put this whole thing together. So that's why I'm out here in the first place, but I'm running on three life or death issues: the climate crisis, inequality, because inequality kills. We've got a 20-year life expectancy gap between our richer and poorer counties. And then we got this new nuclear arms race where they're putting more tactical nuclear weapons into conventional forces and updating all the strategic nukes, and we're getting out of these treaties. So I'm calling for no first use, unilateral disarmament to a minimum credible deterrent, and then getting the nuclear powers together for serious negotiations for complete nuclear disarmament. And so I'm running to put those issues in the debate to get ballot lines for the Green Party so we can build this party from the bottom up in local races in the next election cycle, and to help the Greens become better organizers, not just activists who show up, but organizers who know how to, you know, bring people together and get things done. So that's what the campaign's about.
Okay. You mentioned peace and disarmament and global warming and climate change. Do you think those issues are related?
Absolutely. I mean, the money we need for what we call a Green New Deal. I was actually the first candidate to run on a Green New Deal in 2010, and the Democrats have taken it and they've taken the brand but watered down the content. Among the content they watered down was we were calling for deep military spending cuts and putting that money into a clean energy transition. So they're connected in that way. And then militaries are enormous carbon polluters as well as other forms of pollution. So they're linked in that way. And inequality, the Green New Deal is not just a energy transition program to get to zero greenhouse gas emissions and 100% clean energy. It's an economic bill of rights. When I ran on in 2010, we're coming out of the Great Recession. Actually, we led with the economic bill of rights. The climate issue was not so much at the forefront then, although we were well aware of it. We were calling for a 10-year transition by 2020 to zero greenhouse gas emissions and 100% clean energy. Of course, now here we are almost at 2020, so we need now the goal is 2030, and we're really at the edge there. But the Economic Bill of Rights makes sure everybody has the right to a job with a government employer last resort, an income above poverty, a decent home, comprehensive health care, good education, public education, lifelong from pre-K to college, and a secure retirement. In that respect, we're calling for a doubling of Social Security benefits. So that's how we address inequality with the Green New Deal, and it's connected to militarism because that's where the money is being wasted and should be put into this fight against climate change.
Okay. So the other thing is, you know, when we're talking about a carbon footprint for this military-industrial complex, I think we have to talk about the entire carbon footprint, the manufacturing of weapons. You know, you're talking about iron ore mining and all the processing that takes place and the manufacturing. This is all a huge carbon footprint. Then in the aftermath of war, you have to rebuild. That leaves a bigger carbon footprint, cutting down trees and everything to rebuild homes. And, you know, you got to mine again to get the steel to and the cement to rebuild the cities and everything that are blown to bits. I mean, we're talking about a huge carbon footprint as a result of militarism and war. So, you know, I certainly agree with that.
What about you, Stuart?
Well, I think, especially when you look at the carbon footprint from militarism, the U.S. is one of the largest polluters on the planet. Not only do we sell weapons throughout the globe, but we're also the instigators of many of these dirty wars. So, unfortunately, we have an administration and the head of that administration that doesn't take climate change seriously. We had a problem with that that I could see back in the 50s and the 60s. We were talking about pollution and what we needed to clean up pollution here in California back in the 60s, when sometimes you couldn't even go out in public and even breathe because it felt like, even with myself moving back to California in 66, sometimes it felt like I had rocks that were sand that was in my chest. The pollution was that bad. Over the years, we have come in with various regulations to help to clean the environment and clean the air. And now I notice in the part of Riverside County where I live here in California, I can actually look to the north and I can see the mountains. If you go back to 1970 and 73 and 4, many times you couldn't see no more than 2 or 3 miles away from you. So right now we have an administration that is making an assault on preventing the climate change as it is a real problem in the world. The other thing is, Alan mentioned, anytime you go into wars, it has been the practice for hundreds of years. Whoever the victor is, your responsibility is to clean up your mess behind the vanquished. And we saw the same thing that happened in Germany. We saw what happened in World War I, and we have seen this over several wars. Well, what Alan just mentioned, when you go back in to rebuild something that was already structures that were already in place, and now you have destroyed that, now you need to go back and rebuild, that is actually creating damage to the ecosystems of the entire planet. So I agree exactly what Howie said, and also I agree with what Alan said as well.
Yeah, and we had some friends that were on our program, I don't know, a month or so ago. They made a trip to Cuba, I guess before they stopped it, before Trump stopped the visits. But there was a tornado there, and it damaged a neighborhood, some homes. And within, I think, 4 or 5 months, they said they had rebuilt, the government had rebuilt their homes, and they were back in their homes. But, of course, that doesn't weigh in as much as the hurricane that happened in the Bahamas, that a Category 5 that sat over the Bahamas for a couple of days. That was devastating. But, you know, it seems to me like, in the past, you could Category 5 was fairly rare in hurricanes, but now it's commonplace. It seems like every hurricane that comes in is Category 5.
You think this is part
one of the other things
change?
I want to mention is we have a situation over in Japan, the Fukushima plant, that actually was hit by that earthquake that happened some years ago, and right now they have thousands and millions and millions of gallons that they are looking at releasing out into the ocean, contaminated water, and releasing this into the Pacific Ocean. What this is going to do, this is going to create devastation to much of the wildlife and also the fish in that region, and also it's going to have an impact on the U.S. Right now, that requires an international response. We don't see an international response. We don't even see the U.S. getting even involved as to how this should be dealt with. I'm just curious, what actions do you think should be taken on the part of the U.S. in regards to them releasing these millions and millions of gallons of water into the Pacific Ocean?
Well, I don't want to see it released. I don't know technically how you can prevent it from being released. I just haven't got into that story yet, but I will tell you this. The idea that nuclear power, as some suggest, is a carbon-free source of energy, it's not safe energy, as Fukushima demonstrates. And we got 440 nukes around the world, and all this hazardous waste that we don't know what to do with. There's always the danger of catastrophic accidents like Fukushima. And, of course, they can contribute to the nuclear arms race, because countries that are nuclear learn about nuclear technology and they can convert that into weapons making. So one thing I think we need to do is the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty has three parts. One is don't let new countries get nuclear weapons. Second part is negotiate complete nuclear disarmament. This has been around since 1970. It's never really been pursued. But the third part is to spread the so-called peaceful atom. That part of the treaty is wrong. We should now be spreading the solar alternative, which relies on that nuclear power plant, that fusion plant in the sky, the sun. And so we got to get off nuclear power. I don't know what to do technically about Fukushima, but I guess the headline I've read, and I haven't had time to get into it, is, you know, it was either the Prime Minister of Japan or the head of the relevant company was saying, we have no alternative. And I don't believe that.
Right.
I mean, this water's been stored there so far. It's also been leaking. So what I think, without having delved into it, is that they're probably saying we got to discharge the water so we can go in there and start picking up and isolating the contaminated, you know, metal and whatnot. I'm not sure about that, but you know, I don't want to see a big release of nuclear radioactive water into the ocean. That can't be good.
And much of what Howie was just mentioning about the leaking of radioactive materials, this goes back to when they were doing testing in the Pacific back in the 40s and early 50s. And in those islands where they were doing the testing, they actually took much of the contaminated materials and they actually buried those materials on several of those, mainly on a couple of the islands there. And now those facilities where they actually buried that nuclear material, those containment sites are starting to leak. So we have, I shouldn't say we have a long ways to go when it comes to harnessing the power of nuclear energy. Right now we need to just shut it down.
Yeah, I agree.
What do you think about in the presidential debate, the way they've handled this whole issue of nuclear weapons proliferation and also nuclear power?
They haven't. You know, the only mention of nuclear war was Tulsi Gabbard when she was asked what a top issue is. And it wasn't really about nuclear disarmament or the nuclear modernization program or no first use. She's actually co-sponsor of a bill in the House for that. She didn't even bring that up. It's not on her website. I think it was about the fact that, you know, her home state, Hawaii, had that false alarm about North Korea, and she's worried about the new Cold War with Russia, which is part of this arms race because Russia's also modernizing. In fact, because the Russians and the Americans are doing it, the Chinese and the Indians, who had policies of no first use and a minimum credible deterrent, are getting away from that because they're worried about being wiped out in a first strike. So, you know, this arms race is really on.
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion, when you consider all the Democrats that are in the House and the Senate, when they have just signed on to a $1.4 trillion budget for the military over the next 2 years, in addition to that, every military funding program to come across the president's desk, it is signed by him and is backed by all the members of Congress, whether they're Democrat or the Republicans. So we don't have any of the candidates that are is taking any type of position there in regards to nuclear proliferation. And I might emphasize, so many people may not be aware, that it was the United States was the first one that initiated to under Obama to spend $1 trillion over the next 10 years to upgrade the nuclear facilities in this country. Those funds were also approved by the Democrats and Republicans. So we have a problem on both sides of the aisle, and that's why we need people like Howie that can go in and speak against this type of nonsense that's taking place in Congress.
Yeah, it's really a shame that none of them have spoke out against the nuclear modernization. Bernie Sanders, that didn't come up in the debates. His Green New Deal does phase out nuclear power, and I think that's a good thing. It's the first time I've seen that from any Democrat. But aside from that, you know, they're just not talking about it.
Probably because there aren't mass movements. The only reason we got these nuclear treaties to begin with is because there was a massive international movement demanding these treaties be between the nuclear countries. And we don't have the ban the bomb movement and stuff anymore going internationally. I think that's a big problem, and I don't know. It's not just about politics. It's about getting people into the streets and creating huge movements to back these things, I think.
Well, we do actually have a movement in the countries that are non-nuclear. 2 years ago, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons got the Nobel Peace Prize, and hardly anybody in this country knows that. But they got 122 nations to agree to the text of a treaty called the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and they got the Nobel Peace Prize for that achievement. The problem was none of the nuclear powers, and there are, I guess, 8 of them, participated in formulating that treaty. So there is a movement out there in other countries that are non-nuclear. And, you know, the thing is, the peace movement here, the green movement, you know, progressives generally have got to get with that, because this is an existential threat. You know, we're modernizing all our strategic forces. These conventional forces, they're making it easier to use tactical nukes, and they'll never stay tactical. It'll go strategic and blow up the world. And this is, you know, as serious as the climate crisis. So one thing I'm hoping is, you know, not just me, but other green and other independent left candidates make this an issue in 2020 and hopefully, you know, be the Paul Revere's or whatever that sounds the alarm and we get a movement going. Because you're right. Until there's a movement, the politicians aren't going to respond.
Yeah. Getting off this issue a little bit, what are your thoughts about when it comes to labor issues like at-will employment? I know Bernie Sanders, he just finally came out against at-will employment. What are your thoughts about at-will employment?
Well, yeah, at-will employment means the boss can fire you for any damn reason he wants to or she wants to. And
right.
The alternative to that is to have a law for only – you can only be terminated for just cause. You know, if the business can't afford to keep you, that's a reasonable cause. But they shouldn't be able to fire you because the boss wants to put their cousin in your job. So this gets rid of favoritism and arbitrary treatment of workers. Montana has a law like that. Most European countries have a law like that. The whole United States should have a law like that.
Okay. I agree with that. Did you have any thoughts about the UAW strike that's on right now?
Well, you know, a lot of the top UAW tops have been charged with graft, and now the FBI has raided the president and the former president of the union, their homes last month. And meanwhile, this strike was called, but, you know, I know a lot of UAW people, they were not informed by, you know, contract bulletins. They really weren't invited. There was no preparation for the strike. They aren't even sure what the leadership strategy is. So, you know, they're out there on the picket line, but it's not like this was a well-thought-through thing. So they're going to have to do this on their own. I think the thing the workers got to watch out for is that, you know, they do this strike, it's a token strike, and then they come back with a slightly modified contract and tell them to vote it through. That's when they got to vote no and really demand what they want. And the big issues are the company wants them to pay a lot more for health care. The wage offer is less than the rate of inflation, and it does nothing about these tiered employee system where some people are working under the old rate, other people are working on a new rate, and then they got these temps who come in who have they're not even protected by the contract, and they undercut the wages of the workers that do work under the contract and also undercuts the solidarity that workers need to fight the bosses. So there are a lot of problems there. And the other thing I'll say about this is, you know, this goes back 10 years. I worked with people in the auto workers caravan when, you know, the companies were going bankrupt and the federal government spent $81 billion bailing out the auto companies. The workers drove down to Washington while the jets flew in their corporate, you know, private jets. And the workers were saying, don't only just, you know, buy the stock of these companies so they can, you know, stay in business and, you know, or give, you know, they gave them money so they could stay in business. Invest in a whole new green industry, solar and wind equipment, electric cars, electrified light rails in the cities, and don't just save the auto industry you got. Expand the manufacturing base to produce this green technology we need. And they were basically calling for a Green New Deal. And I saw those people outside the Democratic debate where climate activists and union members came out, and the slogan of the demonstration was, make Detroit the engine of a Green New Deal. But what I would argue is that won't happen until we do what we did during World War II, when the federal government took over or built a quarter of the manufacturing in this country in order to turn industry on a dime into what was called the arsenal of democracy to fight the fascist Axis powers. We need to do nothing less in terms of federal action, federal ownership, and planning to fight climate change. And if we do that, the auto workers, they won't be closing plants, or the industry won't be closing. We'll be building plants to build all this equipment we need for the Green New Deal.
So we're getting into public ownership and nationalization. Do you think that's suitable for the auto industry today?
Well, I think the federal government needs to plan it. They need to build it. They might even need to take over some of these companies. But once it's built, what we do different this time, unlike World War II, where, you know, the federal government spent a lot of money and then they sold it back to the super rich and their big corporations for pennies on the dollar invested. That should stay in public ownership, but some of these plants should be leased out to the workers as a worker co-op so they can manage the labor process and equitably share the surplus they create. And so it would have public ownership with workers' control. And I think that would be the best way to administer a lot of these factories. Other things should probably be publicly administered, like a nationalized railroad system or a nationalized healthcare system, you know, Medicare for all or a national health service. So I think it depends on the industry. But in the case of these factories, I think public ownership and lease them out to worker cooperatives.
What are your thoughts on that, Stuart?
Well, I think when it comes to public transportation, like how we just mentioned when we have various transit systems, is badly needed here in California. I can see that we were talking about a high-speed rail system going through the interior of California. They started working on this. It was approximately well over a decade ago. They were projecting the cost was going to be right at around $3 billion. Now the cost has escalated to well over $15 billion, and the numbers, they don't even have a plan. They haven't even started laying tracks for this. But the thing is, I think this is something that needs to be financed by the federal government, the state and the federal government. It should not be turned over to private enterprise. We see with many of these toll roads that they have in California and throughout the country, you have a toll road, you get on the toll road, and you have a certain fee that you have to pay for going from A to B. And once you hit those markers, it actually detects that you have that transmitter, and then you charge basically what time of day that you're going and how the use at that time. Well, I think when it comes to public transportation, this is the first step where the nation, state and the federal government should be able to improve the transportation systems of this country. We're always talking, these politicians are always talking about money toward infrastructure. They're talking about the billions of dollars. We saw under Obama, he was talking about how he was going to create jobs and more jobs and improving the infrastructure of this country, and they were going to have shovel-ready jobs. You saw this Trump, when he went into office, he was saying that, you know, he was a businessman and he built high-rises and he knew how to create jobs. So where are the jobs that he has created for working people? So as Howie mentioned, we could build transit systems along many of our systems, where along many of our city corridors, where people could be able to get on light rail and they could be able to do it at minimum fees to be able to go from one area of a city or county to another. And this is what we need to do to modernize our transit systems. The other thing I want to mention is important is that the government has had a tendency over the last 30 years or so, when certain companies, you see that they're going out of business and filing bankruptcy, and then the federal government, even with General Motors, with Chrysler, we have seen those companies where the federal government bailed those companies out. This crapola that we hear about, too big to fail. Well, if the government goes in, say for instance like an airline, and they bail an airline out, well, I think once the government goes in and pays the bill, pays the tab. They bail that company out. I think it should be turned over to the workers of that company, and where it should be worker-owned and worker-operated. We have seen that it can work. I go to a company on a regular basis here in California. It's called Winco. It's worker-owned and worker-operated. The workers receive the profits from that business. We need to do this with many of these companies that the federal government's bailing out and make it so it's benefiting the working people instead.
Okay. So when we talk about financing these kinds of projects, I think we have to maybe talk about public banking too, because the interest rates that the banks charge the government, you know, if you look at the public schools or anything, when they build schools, these bond proposals, all this money going into interest to these bondholders, you know, I think we need some kind of public banking system. How do you guys feel about that? Howie?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve has been a complete failure, but I'll let Howie start with that one.
Well, I think there's several sources of funding. First thing is we got to tax the rich. They're not putting their money to good use. They're buying financial assets, which means they're buying stocks and bonds. They're just rearranging who owns the real assets those stocks and bonds represent. They're not investing in new assets, especially not a new green economy. So we should take that extra money they don't need for their own consumption, and they're not investing in productive assets, and invested in productive assets through the public sector. So wealth tax, more progressive income tax, estate tax. We need to raise the cap on the Social Security tax so that the rich don't get free after they make $130,000. And financial transactions tax. I mean, there are lots of ways we can get money from the rich. And then, yes, we still have to borrow because these are investments we need to make now if we're talking about the Green New Deal. We don't have time to wait. And there are two ways of doing that. One is to borrow, and public banks are better than borrowing through Wall Street. North Dakota has a state bank. It's operated for 100 years. It's always made money for the state. It partners with the farmers, the local businesses, student loans, home loans, and it does it at lower cost to the borrower than, you know, having to pay the fees and profits to Wall Street. It's a proven model. But the other thing that the Green Party advocates is that it's what the populists advocated in the 19th century, greenbacks. Instead of creating debt-tied money, I mean, the way we expand the money supply now is that the Treasury issues bonds, the bondholders, the bond market buys that. That's basically the rich folks. And then sometimes the Fed buys it in the secondary market. They can't buy it directly from the Treasury and supports that market. That's called quantitative easing, when they buy those assets and those treasuries and hold them. But in the end, the taxpayers got to pay that back to the rich, mostly, who own the bonds. So it's really a way of transferring wealth to the rich. The greenbacks are just issued. They're printed and or digitized these days and printed and then spent by the Treasury Department on programs and investments of the federal government. That's what we did during World War II. That's where we got the name greenbacks. They were just green paper money. We did it to finance the Revolutionary War. They were called Continentals. So we don't have to rely on banks to create money. The government should do it. In fact, the Constitution says it's the responsibility of Congress to coin money. Instead, we've turned it over to private bankers. So that's a radical demand. But if we can't get the greenbacks, we should have public banks and do green quantitative easing. This time, we bail out the people in the planet, not the banks. We can also find money for what we need by cutting the military budget. I'm saying we should cut it by 75%. That'd be roughly $750 billion that could go right into this. And then the other thing is, and actually Bernie Sanders pointed this out in his Green New Deal, we build public assets. We build public transportation systems, public housing that's, you know, net negative carbon. We build the interstate renewable electricity system. And we build these things, and people are going to pay for the electricity. They're going to pay for the transit fares. They're going to pay their rents for the public housing. And we're going to build, you know, green equipment, you know, the wind generators and the solar panels. And if they're built by publicly owned entities, those will be sold. All that's revenue that will come in and reduce the net cost of this investment we're making. Sanders says, and he doesn't show his homework, that it would pay for itself. And I think it might, just because they're good investments. And, you know, once you've built, you know, a solar panel, you don't have to buy fuel. That'll let you, the sun is shining. So it's a lower cost. And, you know, we charge for the electricity, and that brings money back into the federal government, which put it out there in the first place. So we can borrow money now and may be able to pay it back, and the whole program will pay for itself. So those are four areas, you know, basically tax the rich, borrow money through the public sector, public banks, or greenbacks, cut the military budget, and then take revenues in from the sales of public goods and services.
Okay.
It's not the problem. I just add this. Financing a Green New Deal or these things we need is not the problem. You know, we got the technology. We got the capital for the initial investment. It can pay for itself. The problem is we're going to create so many jobs, we may not have enough people. That'll be the bottleneck in getting this done in a rapid rate to deal with the climate crisis.
Yeah,
well, the only comment I want to make in regards to that, a couple of things I want to mention, is that we have seen over the past few years, I want to support a candidate that's going to support what's good for working people, not what's good for a Democrat or Republican Party. And that's what we have seen with Bernie Sanders over the years, is that ultimately at the end of the day, he throws his support for the Democratic Party. We need to have a candidate. We need to build a labor working class movement in this country. We need to have a labor party where we have our own candidates. And if we're talking about a Green Deal, what candidates are representing working people and what ideas they have in regards to a Green Deal? I don't think Bernie Sanders is that man. I think Bernie Sanders has sold out to the Democratic Party. They have ownership on him. And if he was as genuine as many people think as a Democratic socialist, he would already have gone the route that we have seen with Gabbard, where the party basically, she is putting her ideas out there in regards to U.S. military involvement in the Middle East and what should be done to change what has taken place in the Democratic Party, and they have already put a target on her back. Bernie Sanders has nothing to worry about because he is definitely entrenched in the Democratic Party. And that's one of the reasons why I think, Howie, what you're talking about, a Green Deal, I think you need to go to the working people and get them to support that idea.
Well, that's why I was in Detroit and, marching with the auto worker caravan and other union people for that rally to outside the Democratic debate. You know, I agree. Bernie cannot deliver what he's talking about through the Democratic Party. Take Medicare
Never.
For all. You know, Pelosi's already said we ain't doing that, and she's in charge. You know, Bernie and the squad are really on the margin of the Democratic Party. They make it look better than it is. As far as Tulsi Gabbard goes, you know, I have a more critical opinion of her. She calls herself, by her own description, a war on terror.
Don't get me wrong. I don't support her. I don't support
her. Okay, but
she has a target on her back.
Well, she says no regime change wars, but she is for war on terrorism wars, and sometimes it's hard to figure out which is
which. That's one reason why I don't support her.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. She has zero support for me.
Yeah, we need our own party. We need our own party so we can speak with our own voice, our own identity, and we're not getting all lost in the sauce in the Democratic Party. You know, where some progressives make it sound a lot better than it really is.
One thing I like about you, Howie, is you're a worker voicing your opinions very vigorously, and I think more working people got to begin to do this, and you set a good example. Go ahead.
Let me just, one comment on that is, you know, I hear that at work, but then, you know, workers often don't have the confidence to go out in public. And that's where a party, and actually our unions, but that's another question about reforming the unions. should be helping people develop their, you know, public confidence so they can go out and speak their minds. And I think, you know, working people, you know, they've been taught their whole life through the public school system and its, you know, so-called meritocratic rankings and tracking and so forth, that, you know, they aren't really worthy of speaking in public. That goes to the ones that went to law school or whatever. And the fact is, you know, I know lawyers and I know working people. A lot of times the working people have a much clearer sense of what's going on. The lawyers and, the, you know, the professionals often have an inflated sense of their power that the capitalists really have, just because, you know, I guess they can speak their mind at work, but, you know, it's the boss that makes the decision. In any case, I think a party is what we need also to help workers find their voice and their confidence to speak out.
Right.
I want to ask you, Howie, is the Green Party that party that could be a labor party, a party for working people?
Oh, it could be. It's not now.
Not
because,
but could it be?
And it's not because we don't have mostly working people. We do. I mean, in my experience, you know, the socialist groups around tend to be based on the campuses, whereas the Greens are based in the communities as a general rule. But we're not well enough organized now to, you know, expand the base. You know, we have the core people who are activists, you know, in various issues, peace, anti-war, and so forth, and economic justice issues. But they tend to mobilize, not organize. In other words, organize new folks and expand the base. And that's where the Green Party needs to get better at, so we can, you know, half the working people, well, most of the working people, half the public doesn't vote. And they don't vote because I don't think they're apathetic in most cases. They're alienated. They don't think either party speaks for them, knows what their problems are, is paying them any attention. So they say, I'm not going to pay them, and, you know, the politicians any attention. And that's where we're at. So there's a huge vacuum there that the Greens or somebody on the left should fill.
I've received a lot of people that have expressed support that Howie is running as a candidate, and many of those supporters that I have, many of those people that have spoken out in support, they're actually Green members, so I'm very impressed with that.
You brought up Medicare for All. We should probably discuss this because it's a hot issue. The whole thing with health care, the whole health care mess is a hot issue in this country right now. And, you know, I really don't see Medicare for All as a real alternative. And we have to, I think, begin to talk about health care in terms of public being publicly funded, publicly administered, and publicly delivered based on the model of public education, which works very well and accomplishes what it's set out to do. And I think healthcare could be established in the same way in this country. I don't. You have any thoughts on that, Howie?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Back in the 70s, we had three alternatives. It was the Nixon bill, which is basically employer-provided insurance, an employer mandate, and similar to what we got with Obamacare eventually. That was a Republican plan that the Democrats implemented. And then we had the Kennedy bill, which is, it was called National Health Insurance. That's what today in the Democratic Party, Warren and Sanders are calling Medicare for All. And then we had the Dellums bill, which was a national health service, which, as you described, you know, would be publicly funded, publicly administered, and what was the other public? But it was basically like our school system. You have locally elected
publicly
boards.
Publicly funded, administered, and delivered.
And delivered, right. And see, the criticism of the socialized insurance or national health insurance or Medicare for All is that the hospitals and the doctors and the other providers and the drug companies will all feed at the public trough of insurance, public insurance, and you won't be able to control costs and you won't be able to be as responsive to the consumers, the people, of the consumers of healthcare, as you would under a publicly administered system that's democratic. So the Dellums bill provided for locally elected boards that federated at the state and national level, so the system was under the control of the people. And then the doctors and the other health providers were salaried. They weren't in private income-maximizing organizations. and that would give you cost control. They'd get good salaries, but it would be a much better system. It's what England has. It's what Denmark has. It's what Costa Rica has. It's what Cuba has. And those are some of the top healthcare systems in the world. Now, I kind of fudge things by saying Medicare for all, but I have in mind a national health service. I actually like the way Mike Gravel put it. He said, pass this Medicare for all bill right now and then move to the national health service. And that's basically what England did, but it took them, you know, how many years? Like 30, 40 years. They got an insurance program in the early 20th century, and after World War II got their health service. I'm not thinking of such a long period. You know, I think we should be talking about a health service now. So that's what I advocate. And the irony is, you know, back in the 70s we had three choices. Now we got two, and the progressive choice, the left choice in the Democratic primary, was the middle-of-the-road choice back in the 70s.
And part of the problem I see when you have Medicare for all is that we're talking about a national health care program which is publicly funded, publicly administered, and also publicly delivered. When you have Medicare for all, you have to realize that you're still going to have those health maintenance organizations out there that's going to be gouging under Medicare. They're going to be gouging the federal government for, you know, more than their share. And when you have a national health care program, this is what we say, publicly funded, federal government. It comes through the government, publicly administered. And that way you don't have companies, health maintenance organizations out there that you're paying, you know, $3, $4, $5, more than $500,000 for doctors and or other physicians. It cuts that cost. So Medicare, you know, is good for seniors, and Medicare for all, it sounds good, but I don't think that's the route that we should take, because ultimately what it's going to do under this current system that we have, it is going to only feed into the pockets of these big corporations, where they'll still be able to gouge the federal government and gouge the public.
What do you all think
as a Medicare recipient for the last couple of years, I'm getting a lot more copays and deductibles than I did, or services not covered than I did under my Teamsters contract. So there are a lot of gaps in Medicare. So that's another reason that we got to go beyond Medicare as it is now for all. Now, the proposals do expand the services. And, you know, the bills are talking about there'd be no out-of-pocket expenses. So we call it improved Medicare for all. But that still would have the problems that Alexander just talked about, or Stuart just talked about, because, you know, the health maintenance organizations, the drug companies, they will be trying to get as much as they can out of the insurance, the public insurance system.
Yeah, I'm noticing I'm paying a lot more now that I'm retired than when I was with the phone company. But another issue that I don't know if you all want to talk about it, we're noticing a lot of things you have to pay if you want to read newspapers online. You have to. There are a lot of things that seem to be censored nowadays with the newspapers that we get online, with YouTube.
Everything.
What are your thoughts on that?
Neutrality.
Well, in terms of the internet and access, first thing is we need to get net neutrality back. So companies can't, you know, be charging you for favored access, or the people with money get, you know, favored position on the internet. We need to have a interstate broadband system, you know, community broadband, but initiated at the federal level, be community control of, you know, each local jurisdiction. But that's the only way we're going to get over this digital divide, because in the first place, a lot of people don't have access. they still got dial-up, or they don't even have access at all. Rural areas, it's they're just not hooked up. Inner cities, a lot of people can't afford it. So we've got to establish, because being able to get on the internet now is essential. You know, you need it for job applications. You need
it for everything.
Public benefits. You need it pretty much for everything. And so the people that aren't hooked up are being left behind and cut out of the economy.
And what I see is with the net neutrality, it basically boils down to you got to pay to play. And when you consider the internet actually is the federal government. Ultimately, the federal government owns the internet. But what they have done is they have made it so pay to play, where it's beneficial to big corporations, and it benefit them as far as where they able to add to the profits and the growth of their businesses. But what it does is it exclude working class people, as you just mentioned, Deborah, where almost anything you need to do is going to be some type of cost associated with that. Even if you need to read certain information, or you need to go, gain that information from the internet. So, I think this is something that, you know, Howie, this should definitely be part of his platform, where people can realize that, you know, we need to have a system that is fair for working people and not benefiting only big corporations.
You know, another thing about the news is that we need public funding for a diverse media. You know, when the country was founded, we had subsidized postal rates so pamphlets and books and newspapers could get around. And they saw that as essential to having an informed electorate. And now we're at a point where you got to pay to get the basic news. The newspapers can't survive because they can't get the advertising, because everybody's online. A lot of problems there. So we need to figure out a way to have, local boards that, you know, hand out or, you know, provide grants to, you know, investigative reporters, different forms of media in communities, so that, we can find out what's going on. It's the New York Times and the Washington Post are doing okay. They got investigative staffs. But if you go to the local news in most cities, it's a fraction of what it used to be. You can't find out what your city government's doing, what happened in court, what the county's doing. It's pathetic. And you have elections coming up, and, you know, at best, if you still got a newspaper, they do a perfunctory profile of each candidate. They don't cover this campaign. And that's it's really a shrinking of, what news people can get, particularly in local communities, what's going on in the community that's closest to them and matters most in terms of everyday life.
Okay, I hate to cut this conversation off, but we don't have enough time to do much more. But I would like to invite you back, Howie, because a couple people have some questions they want to ask you about the Green Party itself and the internal workings and the campaigns within the Green Party. So maybe you can come back on the program another time and we'll discuss those things.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Okay, and Stuart, you want to give a plug for your program?
Yes, I'd like to invite your listeners to tune in to or click on the link Socialist Can, 1 hour left. We are on every Wednesday, 6 o'clock Pacific, 9 o'clock Eastern, and we'll be on this week. We look forward to having people to join us in our roundtable discussion, which Alan, Deborah, and also we will have Lauren Palmer will be joining us this week. Look forward to it. Thank you.
And thanks for joining us, Howie and Stuart, and we'll be glad to have you on again. It was a good program. Thank you.
Thank you
for
the invitation.
For having me.
Okay.
Good night.
Right.
Yeah.